I am really lucky today. In the studio, I have two people who are going to help me out. I have Cedric Clute.
Good morning.
Good morning, Cedric. How are you today?
Just fine, thank you.
Well, that's great. Cedric does Tales of the Motherlode here on KVGC. And Cedric, when is your program on?
It's on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 9 a.m. and again at 3 after the news.
And you just do little short tales of the history?
Yeah,
of...
I've done them now for 20-odd years.
And I know I've been fortunate to hear it now and then. I'm always so busy running around, I don't get to listen to the radio that often. But whenever I get to hear you, I really enjoy it.
Well, thank you very much.
You always have something really interesting to say about the Motherlode. My other guest is Bob Yeager. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
Welcome. Bob's here all the way from Oakland, right?
That's correct.
And you're a writer?
Yes, uh-huh.
Tell us just a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a professional writer for my entire life. Started out as a journalist, worked for the Associated Press as a correspondent, and I've written for many national magazines, the New York Times, Reader's Digest, and many of those. And for a long time I was what they called an originals writer for the Digest, meaning that I would, you know, so much of their material was excerpted from other magazines, but they would send me out around the country, and I would do original stories for them. And it kind of got me interested in fiction writing, because there's a lot of dramatization that goes into stories like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've now written a couple of novels. I've just published one called The Romanoff Stone, and I'm working on a new one.
Well, it's a real honor to have you with us today.
Well,
I'm glad
you
could be here.
My pleasure.
We are doing a... special Halloween show today, because Halloween is just right around the corner. And I asked on previous programs and on my website, I've asked people to send in poems that they wrote or any short stories that would be spooky enough to read around Halloween. And we have a submission from our favorite friend, Glenn Watson. Glenn lives here in the Gold Country, and he is just a master of doggerel and fun stuff. And he has written a takeoff on Poe's The Raven. Cedric, you're going to read that for us.
Yes, I'll try.
Okay, well, give it a go.
Shall I begin?
We are ready.
Once upon a midnight dreary, from reading tomes my eyes were bleary, my weary head began to drowse, when something caused me to arouse. Outside my door I heard a creaking, as if someone there was sneaking, and through my keyhole might be peeking. What mischief might this ghoul be seeking? How strange, I thought, I live alone. The cause of this is quite unknown. Foreboding flooded through my core. I must see what's behind that door. I flung it open as though to stare, but no form nor sound was caught out there. Into this void I blindly groped to apprehend this thing, I hoped. From nowhere came a vice-like grip to free myself. I couldn't slip. My will was not mine to command. I was captive of a mummy's hand. It led me to a crypt quite dismal, into the depths of earth abysmal, the passageway with bones about. I had no hope of getting out. At tunnel's end a shining light, which led me to a welcome sight. 'Twas filled with laughter, song, and cheers, and friends I had not seen in years. I delighted meeting them once more. They appeared just like they were before. Old lovers there we hugged and kissed. With former teammates I reminisced. I must go back, the world to tell. I'd found the opposite to hell, but going back, I had to learn once in this room there's no return.
Wow, once in this room there's no return. Woo. Thanks, Glenn. And thanks, Cedric, for
doing such a great job
reading that. Yeah, it was fun. Glenn is a lot of fun. He's been on the program a couple of times, and we always love to have offerings from Glenn. Well, you know, I did ask our listeners to send me Halloween poems, and also I want you folks to send me things for Thanksgiving and Christmas, Hanukkah coming up, New Year's. Send me things that you've written, because I would love to give your material a chance to be heard on the air here. And one of our listeners, his name is Paul Sohar. He lives in Warren, New Jersey. Paul was really nice enough to send me several poems, and they're pretty darn good. And he sent me two for Halloween. And so Bob Yeager is going to read one. It's called What Ghosts Tell Me. And this is from Paul Sohar.
What ghosts tell me? Smart enough to pass for normal, I pass through life like everyone, pretending to know where I'm going, why I've done what I've done. A half-wit knowing less than half of life's elusive mystery, I see only when I have the wits scared out of me, when the night transfigures slyly from everyday darkness to a ghost, I realize that worldly wisdom is nothing but a hollow boast. When I see things in the darkness that are not supposed to exist, and hear confounding voices coming from the strangulating mist, I know the world is full of wonders. Only the witless are to see when ghosts and goblins come around to poke fun at hard reality.
Thanks, Bob. And thank you, Paul. I hope that Paul will continue sending things, because I'm really enjoying them. So, Cedric, you've just moved to Jackson.
That's right.
Yeah. Where'd you come from?
Well, we came to Jackson now from Volcano, but we got to Volcano 30-some-odd years ago from San Francisco. We had a nightclub there called Earthquake Magoons to have film festivals in at the St. George Hotel in Volcano. And every 6 months, and finally, after things became too hectic in the city, my wife and I decided we wanted to move to Volcano, so that's what we did. But we ran the nightclub in San Francisco for 20-some-odd years.
It was a famous place, Earthquake Magoons.
It was a lot of fun. Originally, it was... We were down on Bay Street in San Francisco in a building that used to be a nightclub called the Sail Inn. And then Turk Murphy, who was a trombone player with the Turk Murphy Jazz Band, my brother was the piano player.
Oh, my God.
And they were partners. And there was a building on the old William Tell Hotel on Clay Street in San Francisco. It was a nightclub for seamen, retired seamen, and they played schottisches, and they had strange little accordion bands in there, and we took over the whole building. We had a three-story flophouse hotel above, rooms rented for $21 a month.
$21 a month?
Yeah. And then we had Earthquake Magoons on the main level and a huge basement. And to make a long story short, we also opened a second nightclub called the Magic Cellar, because we found 30 tons of magic hidden in an old warehouse that had belonged, and the magic belonged to Carter the Great, who was Houdini's business partner.
So
we had both of those things going. It was a lot of fun.
What history, my goodness. No wonder you tell about Tales of the Motherlode here on KVGC. You've got history coming out your eyeballs.
Well, that's how I got my first job up here, working for the Historical Society, by saying I was curator of a museum, and I was actually the curator of the Carter the Great Museum, which was a nightclub. But fair enough.
Yeah. Well, I remember Earthquake Magoons, quite a place.
It was.
Hearing tales about it.
Where was the Magic Cellar?
The Magic Cellar was under Earthquake Magoons, and it was actually a hangout for magicians, but it was also more of a hangout for mystery writers and science fiction writers who congregated there. So Poul Anderson, who was quite a famous science fiction writer, was a regular. Chelsea Quinn Yarbrough, who read tarot cards there and writes novels. I think she's on her 100th book about now. Jack Finney. Lots of people. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, you were there, and you were instrumental in some of the best times of San Francisco, for goodness sakes.
Well, they were. They were wonderful.
How wonderful. How lucky you are. We'll be right back with more tales from my two guests, and we'll get back to Halloween things, too. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices, and we're doing our Halloween show, but you know what? This is so much fun here. We're getting to know Cedric and Bob Yeager. Cedric and Bob have been talking, and Cedric has so much fabulous information. Bob, what question did you just ask him?
Well, I was just asking, Cedric was talking about the years when he owned the Earthquake Lagoon's
manager, my brother. And I didn't own it.
Okay. But there was a very famous band there, the Turk Murphy band. And so I was asking him about a trombonist that I knew of called Jack Teagarden. He was also very famous. And he was answering that question.
Yeah, Jack Teagarden was a very famous trombone player. But he wasn't in San Francisco very much, but his sister Norma was. And she was a pianist and played all over the Bay Area, and she did intermissions for us at Earthquake Lagoon for years and years and years. A very lovely woman. But that brings to mind something else. You're talking about Halloween, and we used to have, down in the Magic Cellar, one time we had a seance on Halloween to resurrect the spirits of Harry Houdini and Carter the Great. And I don't know if there's time to tell the story about the original seance. Harry Houdini died, and they would hold seances. I think that was in 1922, and they would hold seances to try to bring him back, and this was more to get money for widows and orphans and poor magicians than anything else. But the final Houdini seance was held on the roof of the Hollywood Knickerbocker Hotel out in the open. And for 10 years they tried to raise Harry Houdini. And this time, Harry Houdini's publicist, and I can't remember what his name was up there on the roof, and they had a spirit cabinet, a Davenport spirit cabinet up there on the roof, and they had a bell, and they had a tambourine, and for 20 minutes or so, nothing happened, and they were getting ready to close it off when he came out, and just before they finished, the weather had been bad. It rained a little bit. This was October 31st. That's when Houdini died. And it rained on the people. And his publicist came running out and said, "Stop, stop, stop." And he said, "You know, we've been doing things the wrong way." He said, "Harry Houdini wouldn't have come back as an insignificant something shaking a little bell or a tambourine. Harry Houdini would have come back as something dynamic, as something forceful, perhaps as a drop of nature's rain."
Well, I forgot Houdini died on October 31st. Oh, my goodness. He died in a tank, didn't he? He was doing an underwater thing? No?
No.
Oh, that's the movie I saw with Tony Curtis.
No, he didn't die that way. He died of peritonitis.
Okay, tell us that story.
I haven't thought about this for a good many years, but he was at McGill University.
McGill.
And he was lecturing students, and he was lecturing to them about, you know, physical fitness and whatnot. And he would stand there and brace himself and let people hit him in the solar plexus and whatnot. One of the students, he wasn't ready, and one of the students he was talking to just hauled off and hit him in the stomach and knocked him down. And he got up and he said, "I'm okay," and went home. And then a few days later, he had a bad stomach ache, but he said, "Well, I'm not going to do anything about this. If word gets out that Harry Houdini had been knocked down by some kid, it wouldn't be right." Well, anyway, it had ruptured his appendix, and anyway, that's what killed him.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Well, there's a story. I did not know that. I did not know that that happened. I remember seeing a movie with Tony Curtis where he was Harry Houdini.
Yeah.
And he was lowered into a tank of water, and he was handcuffed and all tied up like in a straitjacket, and he had told everybody he could get out. But that was... And I know Houdini had that trick, but I guess that they just made, that's what Hollywood does. They change history and they give you a story that they think is more believable or more exciting. I don't know. Anyway, but you know the real stuff. Now tell us about your friend, the magician who died.
Oh my. His name was Paul Svengari. And he did a lovely show in full dress. And, well, he moved back east. Well, he passed away, and his wife phoned me, and she said, "I'm coming out with Paul." And I said, "What do you mean by that?" She said, "Well, I'm coming out with his ashes because he wants to be sprinkled over his favorite places in San Francisco." And she arrived, and there were so many places listed that what she had done is she'd taken Paul's ashes and mixed them with glitter and put them in vials. And so the first spot was the old location of the Magic Cellar, and that was at Clay and Montgomery. And we arrived in full costume with drums and everything and vials of Paul during rush hour in the morning. It was, I don't know, 8:30 or 9, and we were moving up and down Clay Street because we weren't sure exactly where the location was, the exact location was, because the building had been replaced by a high rise. And there we were going up and down the street, sprinkling Paul all over the place. People must have thought we were crazy.
That's fun. That is just really fun. He must have been a fun guy to know.
Paul was. Yes, he was.
Yeah. Well, your story of Paul in the vials and sprinkling him all over San Francisco, that reminds me of a story that I was told by a woman who was my banker at a credit union in Sacramento when I lived there. Her name was Fenner, and Fenner was just the greatest storyteller. She was just a delightful woman. And she and her sister and her mom had been close all their lives. I don't know if Fenner or her sister had ever married. I kind of got the idea that maybe it was the three women who lived together their whole adult lives and just had the most wonderful times together because they really enjoyed each other. And then mom passed away. And they always called their mom Gran. I don't know why, but they referred to her as Gran. And Gran passed away. And they had her cremated. But they didn't want to leave her behind, so they took her everywhere with them. They put her ashes in a can, kind of a can that you could shake, you know, and you could hear the ashes rattling around in there. And they'd go to the beach, or they'd go to the boardwalk in Santa Cruz, or they'd go to the mountains, and they brought along Gran in a can.
Gran in the can.
She was not your average banker. I always enjoyed going there, even if I didn't have enough money to put in my account. Now, we're going to go back to another poem by Paul Sohar, and Bob's going to read it for us. I caught him by surprise here.
That's all right.
Caught him by surprise. But, yeah, Paul has this other great poem that he sent for Halloween. So here we go with Bob reading it.
Well, this one is called Halloween Song. The night when the invisible, too, can flash an image in your face, when the inaudible can cry out, shrieking through the arcane haze, when the impalpable and impossible stare you in the eye, when the other world demands your attention, you'd better not lie, not pretend you saw nothing at all, heard nothing worthy of your brains. You may never be clever in this world, but somewhere another world attains, another world that sends you signals, attesting to its reality, from a world where there's no question about how to be or not to be. The night when ghosts come messing up your everyday routine and play, a trick on your mind you can release, the scary secrets you kept at bay.
Wow, that's good.
Good.
Thank you, Bob, and thank you, Paul Sohar from New Jersey. You keep listening back there. We like having you with us. And we will be right back. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. This is Linda Field, and I'm here with Bob Yeager. Cedric had to leave us for a while. We hope he'll be back, but I'm here with Bob, and Bob is going to talk about Sutter Creek and the haunted house there.
Well, Linda, I'm going to tell a story that happened to me many years ago when I was working on my first book, and I'd been working very hard for several months, and my wife suggested that we needed to take a break. I needed to take a break. So we decided to go to the Gold Country, and she booked us into a place there neither one of us knew anything about. It's called the Sutter Creek Inn, in Sutter Creek, of course. And we had a room in the main house, which was well over 100 years old, beautiful old house, and our room was up two flights of stairs, and there was a landing. Then our room was at the top. And I noticed as I was walking by the landing that there was a small table with a telephone on it. And so we went somewhere, I can't remember where, we went out to dinner and came back and went to bed. And sometime after midnight, I started hearing a ringing. And it was very persistent. And finally I shook myself awake and I realized it was down on that landing that telephone was ringing. And so I got myself down to the landing and I picked up the phone. And it was a lot of crackling on the line, like an old-time war correspondent broadcast from London or something. there was a lot of crackling, and a voice came on the line, and it was my grandfather's voice.
What?
It was my grandfather's voice. And he always called me Rob. And he said, "Hi, Rob. I always called him Don, Grandpa Don." And he said, "It's Grandpa Don, and I've got someone here who really wants to speak to you."
Now, I'm assuming that your grandfather had passed away sometime before?
No, he was still very much alive.
Oh, okay.
but he said, "I've got someone here with me who wants to talk to you." And there was kind of another flare of this kind of crackling sound, and another voice came on the line. And this was the voice of my grandmother. And she said, "Robert, there's something I must say to you." I said, "What's that?" She said, "I want you to know that I love you." Now, my grandmother had been dead for many years.
Oh, my goodness.
And we had not had the nicest of relationships. We had been at odds when I was a kid and growing up. And so I went back to bed, and when I woke up in the morning, my memory of the conversation was very vivid in my mind, and I thought, well, what's happened? Did I imagine that? And it gnawed at me during the day, and we went around and visited shops and so on. And this Sutter Creek Inn had a tradition at 4 o'clock, all the guests gathered in the parlor of the hotel for sharing in conversation. So we came back, and the parlor was lined with books, and there were books piled on tables, and we sat down on a sofa, and there was a table in front of us, and there was a book right on the top, and the book was called The Haunted Houses of California. And I just started flipping through it idly. It was by Antoinette May.
I think I know her.
And lo and behold, I turned the page, and there I was staring at the section about the Cedar Creek Inn. So I started reading, and what I read was that the Cedar Creek Inn was a very well-known site for seances and for visits by spirits from beyond, and that the woman who owned the Cedar Creek Inn was a well-known medium, known all around the United States. And I looked up from what I was reading, and she was standing about 10 feet from the lady who owned the place and was the medium. And I never forgot that experience, or being in the Cedar Creek Inn. And when I was writing my novel, The Romanoff Stone, I came to a place in the book where I wanted to have, what do you call it, a kind of a magical presence. And I remembered that incident, and it became a brief section in my book, which I can read if you'd like.
Would you read it?
Yeah,
love it.
I think I might have to give you a little bit of background. My book, the heroine of my book, is named Kate DeVille, and she has been on a journey all throughout Europe, trying to find a birthright of her. She's learned on her mother's deathbed that she's an heiress to the Romanoff. She's the last direct descendant of the Romanoff. So she's been in this quest to find her family fortune. And along the way, she's been kind of captured by some nefarious people. And at the moment that this scene takes place, they still have control of her, but they've taken her to Herod's because they have to let her get some clothes and so on so they can travel to this bank where her birthright is locked up in the vault. And so I called this a time traveler. And I'll just read this, and you can see how what happened to me in real life became this fiction. Kate was standing in the spacious but dimly lit Herod's dressing room when she heard the persistent double buzzing sound. It drilled through her lingering disorientation like a dentist's tool. Who knew this room had its own phone? She followed the sound to its source in a cupboard below the clothes rack. Opening the door, she removed a vintage cradle-style telephone. She lifted the receiver and heard a crackly static, like a long-ago radio broadcast from the European front. Turning back toward the room, Kate realized she was not alone. Taking care not to hang up, she put down the telephone and peered more closely at her surroundings. Rectangular, with a chair and dressing table at one end and a floor-to-ceiling mirror at the other. The room was illuminated by a single overhead light, which cast a weak yellow glow across the faded cream-colored walls. A figure stood near the door. Was this one of Novichev's people? A sales clerk? The invader remained motionless and silent. Adjusting to the poor light, Kate's eyes made out the form. It was a young girl wearing an old-fashioned white tunic that stopped at mid-thigh and buttoned up the front from neck to hem. Standing before the dressing table, the girl faced her, but her image was semi-transparent. Kate could see the furniture through her clothing. Her lips moved, but she made no sound. It was only after Kate again picked up the telephone receiver that she could hear the girl's voice. At once, Kate knew her identity. Katya, said Anya Kujapin, I wanted you to see what we wore when I first began dancing. The crackling sound rose and fell behind her words like an electrical storm. Bowing gracefully, the young ballerina extended her arms toward her legs as if to commence a movement or series of steps. We weren't allowed to fully uncover our legs until the early 20th century, she continued. That shouldn't seem surprising. After all, women dancers were forbidden to perform ballet until the middle of the 17th century. Anya tossed her head, stirring that signature auburn whirlpool. I wanted you to see what I overcame, she said. Even as a child, and years before I met Nikki, before I fled Russia with Lydia, before your mother, and before all the rest, too, before the Romanoff Stone. Anya's voice seemed to grow weaker. Kate pressed the telephone receiver closer to her ear. Grandmama, why are you here? She blurted. Because, child, you are my last surviving flesh and blood, because I want you to know how much I love you. And because now that dear Irene is gone, you and I are the only ones to escape the Romanov assassin. Why do you suppose I watch over you, Katinka? Whose voice do you suppose you hear when you face danger, when you make an important decision, when you begin a dive? Kate shook her head. She must be dreaming. Was this an apparition, the result of the drugs Novichok had given her? She felt drowsy again, and the phone seemed heavy. Was the young Anya fading away? Before Kate's eyes, her great-grandmother's form seemed to grow decades older. Now she was the woman Kate had known as a child. This Anya wore a high-neck dress and wire-rimmed spectacles that glinted in the low light. She moved to the chair, sat, and stared fiercely at Kate. You chose not to listen to your inner voice in college, Katya. Listen to it now, she paused, and then spoke again. You must succeed. It is not just a matter of honoring my memory or Irina's memory. It is not even a matter of righting past personal wrongs. You have a rare chance to balance the scales of justice and to help our world in an important way. Many people will be affected by whether you succeed, people you do not know and probably never will. Grandmama, am I really seeing you? Are you really here? Dreams are our destiny, child, the old woman replied. You must dance with your dreams, not with your doubts. Do you remember what I told you when you were little about putting the things you care for at the center of your life? Where your attention goes, Katya, your energy will flow. Focus that attention. Use your energy to defeat our enemy, Imre Novichok. The crackling sound intensified and Anya's voice receded, though her image remained. Kate put down the receiver. Dance with your dreams, not your doubts. What did Anya mean? How had she come to her? Nearly a quarter century had passed since she'd last seen her cherished childhood companion and ally. But never in her life had Kate Greville more desperately needed her relative than now. Crossing the room, she knelt and put her head in the old woman's lap. Wordlessly, Anya Puchata stroked her hair.
Wonderful. That's wonderful. Manzanita Voices. This is Linda Field, and Bob and Cedric have had to leave, so I'm on my own for this last segment of our Halloween show today. I have some more Halloween poems and things to read for you, and so I'll just get right to it. This first one is from Sydney Avey. By the way, if you like her poem, which is called Werewolf Secrets, and if you like her poem and you want to go to her website, it is thesheepwalker.com. That's Sydney Avey, thesheepwalker.com. And she sent me, for Halloween, Werewolf Secrets. I am a thief. I steal my paycheck and fail to pay for my job with my soul. I'm a cut purse. I pick their pockets for knowledge and wisdom and acumen. I'm a miser. I hoard my treasure and bury my passion. They won't find it. I'm a fraud. I pretend interest in goals and objectives and strategies. Late at night, while they sleep, a hairy beast bursts from my breast and devours a plate of plundered riches, a savory base of priceless, stockpiled ingenuity. Sydney Avey, Werewolf Secrets. That sounds like every boss's nightmare. Thanks, Sydney. Now, this next one is one that I wrote, and I'll tell you, it's not finished. It's a poem that I wrote for the Sonora Writers Retreat that was held in Colombia, and we read these poems up in the cemetery late at night under a full moon. It was really spooky and really wonderful, and I'm still working on the end of this, so if you have any suggestions, let me know. It's called Terror on a Halloween Night. Noises at the window, shadows on the wall, candle flame a flickering makes me feel quite small. wind tossing branches on the big oak tree, clouds scudding by the moon, it seems they want to flee. I call out for my family, but no one answers there. They have left me by myself and gone I know not where. Now the wind picks up its pace and shrieks around the corner. Windows rattle, pictures tilt. I fear that I'm a goner. Moaning echoes up above in the darkened rooms. A cold draft whispers by my cheek as though I'm in a tomb. Floorboards creaking overhead, a footstep on the stair. I look to see who made the sound, but nobody is there. Why am I alone here inside this big old house? I try to be invisible, silent as a mouse. Escape I must if I'm to live beyond this frightful night. I tiptoe to the front porch door. It's locked, no key in sight. The key, where is the key? My nerves are all a quiver. I search the drawers, I search my purse. My spine sends out a shiver. I feel the beating of my heart. It thuds inside my chest, like some poor creature captured there. Oh, please, God, give it rest. The key, where can it be? I must escape this trap. Then lightning flashes crazily and thunder roars a clap. Fear builds within my panic mind. I cannot think in calm. Should I go out into the night and brave this building storm? Or stay within this house of fright? Which brings the greater harm? A crash upstairs, scraping of chairs. I swoon with great alarm. Oh, God, have mercy. Please deliver your servant from this test. Show me the way. Help me, I pray, to make the choice that's best. Just then, I spy upon the floor, in dust motes in the corner, the key to open the front door. And that's where I stopped. Give me that last line, okay? I'll read that last three lines again, because I really do need a last line for this. Just then I spy upon the floor, in dust motes in the corner, the key to open the front door. And there you go, folks. It's in your lap. Okay, are you all ready for your Halloween trick-or-treaters this year? I think it's going to be fun. You know what I do? What I did last year, and I'm going to do it again this year. I have this beautiful witch's hat that I bought in downtown Angels Camp. There's a woman in town who makes just gorgeous hats. It's made of a beautiful kind of a deep rosy reddish blackish shimmering fabric, and it has a net that goes all around it, touches my shoulders, and in front of my face it has black spiders glued to the net. It's really something. And then I play Boris Karloff doing Monster Mash. I put that on the CD player along with some other spooky Halloween music, and I open the front windows and just blare it out onto the street. And last year the kids just loved it. They came up and they said, "Boy, we really love your music and we love your hat too." So I'm going to do that this year, and I've invited some friends over to join me. Okay, I have another to read, and I have two more to read. Wonderful. This one was sent to me by Blanche Abrams. It's called The Bouncer. And it takes place at Chicago O'Hare Airport, which just warms my heart because I flew through Chicago O'Hare many, many, many times. And I never saw anything quite like this. This is a Halloween kind of spooky tale. It appeared innocuous enough. Just a miniature rubber bouncy ball. Clear in color, but with red, blue, and gold specks inside, and an occasional eminent glow. It bounced through one of the many walkways that connect terminals together at O'Hare Airport. A few people noticed, but didn't pay much attention. Others turned their lips inward in recollection of their childhood years. Some may have wondered where the child was who tossed it too hard. The sphere rolled into gate B6 and gyrated a few times before resting just beneath the ticket agent's counter. as each person approached, requiring assistance, the orb activated a faint luminescence. Minuscule portholes in the rubber shot out an odorless, colorless substance which traveled within the perimeter of the room. The medium adhered to every passenger it came in contact with, as well as their luggage. Those with short sleeves noticed their skin was slightly sticky and wondered what they had rubbed up against. A loudspeaker announced, "Due to thunderstorms in the area, Flight 508 will not depart at its scheduled time." While pounding his fist on the counter, while pounding his fist on the counter, a disgruntled man yelled, "You mean you can't tell me when we're leaving for San Francisco?" "Sir, I don't control the weather," said the agent. "Please calm down, or I'll be forced to call security." Just as she said this, what sounded like a gunshot exploded. All turned to find a woman dripping with water and apologies. I'm sorry, I didn't know this could happen." She had put an airborne tablet into a bottle of water, sealed it, and then shook it, waiting for it to dissolve. She didn't know that the carbonated pressure would blow the lid off the bottle. Because of the noise, children were now crying and a woman in a wheelchair was shaking. A businessman pulled his right sock down and profusely scratched his leg till it bled. Two Asian teens dropped some belongings on the floor and weren't coordinated enough to pick them up. Others in the room began clawing at their scalps and blowing their noses, which exuded a yellowish, thick fluid. Too many strange symptoms were occurring for anyone to consider them related. Many humans were preoccupied with malfunctioning technological devices. Smartphones were indicating no signal. iPad application icons disappeared from screens. Laptop computers had messages stating that all information was lost. Users were frantically swearing and pushing buttons. They attributed this equipment dysfunction to the severe storms in the area. The delayed plane finally arrived, and everyone was eager to continue on to the next leg of their journey. United's flight crew walked through the gate. The invisible airborne residue settled on the uniforms of all except the co-pilot, who glanced at the ball and winked. An internal code was transmitted to the ball. His dim light faded, his pores closed. As the last passenger left the gate, he began a slow roll along the counter, then the wall, and out of B6. Inside himself, he heard the voice say, "Chicago soon eliminated. San Francisco within 48 hours of landing. New York next." And he was dispatched to the appropriate gate. Ooh, boy, oh boy. Don't travel around Halloween time. Okay, I have one more short one. This is called Revenge, and it's by Anonymous. On the first day, she sadly packed her belongings into boxes, crates, and suitcases. On the second day, she had the movers come and collect her things. On the third day, she sat down for the last time at their beautiful dining room table by candlelight. She put on some soft background music and feasted on a pound of shrimp, a jar of caviar, and a bottle of spring water. When she'd finished, she went into each and every room and deposited a few half-eaten shrimps, dipped in caviar, into the hollow center of the curtain rods. Then she cleaned up the kitchen and left. On the fourth day, the husband came back with his new girlfriend, and at first all was bliss. Then slowly, the house began to smell. They tried everything. Cleaning, mopping, airing out the place. Vents were checked for dead rodents and carpets were steam cleaned. Air fresheners were hung everywhere. exterminators were brought in to set off gas canisters, during which time the two had to move out for a few days. In the end, they even paid to replace the expensive wool carpeting. Nothing worked. People stopped coming over to visit. Repairmen refused to work in the house. The maid quit. Finally, they couldn't take the stench any longer and decided that they had to move. But a month later, even though they'd cut their price in half, they couldn't find a buyer for such a stinky house. Word got out, and eventually even the local realtors refused to return their calls. Finally, unable to live with the odor any longer or wait any more for a buyer, they had to borrow a huge sum of money from the bank to purchase the new place. Then the ex-wife called the man and asked how things were going. He told her the saga of the rotting house. She listened politely and said that she missed her old home terribly and would be willing to reduce her divorce settlement if he would sign the house over to her. Figuring that she could have no idea how bad the smell really was, he agreed on a price that was only one-tenth of what the house had been originally worth, but only if she would sign the papers that very day. She agreed, and within 2 hours, his lawyers delivered the completed paperwork. A week later, the man and his girlfriend stood smiling as they watched the moving company pack everything to take to their new home, and to spite the ex-wife, they even took the curtain rods. I love a happy ending, don't you? Have a happy Halloween.
Can you dig it?
You've been listening to Manzanita Voices, a production of the Manzanita Writers Press, an affiliate of the Calaveras County Arts Council.